Hello, I'm Chris Baisden, an editor with AICPA's Journal of Accountancy. You're listening to the JFA podcast, where we talk about the key issues facing the accounting profession. In today's podcast, we're going to talk about how to open a new CPA office. My guest is Blake Christian, a tax partner with HCVT. Hello, Blake. How are you today?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Good. So, Blake, this is a very important topic, but let's start off a little bit by establishing your bona fides on it. You've opened a new office in Park City, Utah, a few years ago, I know. But how many offices have you opened in your career, and what do you like about doing that?
Well, I've actually opened three, but also been involved in two moves. And what I like about it is you kind of get to put your stamp and personality and functionality onto the office, and it's also a real morale booster for the existing employees. So it's time consuming, but it's also very rewarding.
I bet so. Now, I'm guessing that the first thing you like to do when you're considering opening a new home office, a new office, is some due diligence. What kind of research do you conduct before you're deciding whether or not to open an office in a new city? You know, whether you have a home office or whether you're part of a larger organization.
Right. Well, you want to look at both the business demographics as well as your target market. If it's high net worth individuals, kind of see what the demographics are in not only the city you're going to, but kind of the overall region, because you should be looking at marketing well beyond just your new office space. And you also want to look at the competition. You know, are the big four in town? Are the national firms? What are the smaller local firms, and what are their focus? And how are you going to fit into that market?
I see. And so what kinds of attributes are important to consider in the actual physical location for a new office? I'm thinking maybe parking might be something that would be important for you.
That is number one, but not always, people don't always think about that. But you want to really have plenty of public parking, hopefully in your building. Again, the demographics of your client base. You know, if you have some older clients, if you've got stairs, steps, all that can be an impediment to them getting to the office. So again, you want low priced and plenty of parking.
Absolutely. So I know that there's one thing that you've told me in the past that you should always be careful about when picking a space. Can you share with the audience what that is and talk a little bit about why?
Well, and we have this every time when we walk through space. There's always somebody on the site visit that's, we can move that wall, that. And I just cringe when they mention moving a wall, because it's probably, depending on the structure, $10,000 to $20,000 to blow out that wall. And if you're trying to go for a short-term lease, even a five-year lease, spreading that cost over that rental period, it gets extremely expensive. And so you really want to go into space where you don't have to move walls. If you're taking a whole floor, fine. You can be up for moving walls. But if you're just getting a small space, that can be very cost prohibitive.
Do you have a sense of how many different places you tend to look at whenever you're considering a location? How many different buildings that you visit? I mean, I'm sure it varies by the office, but I mean, are we talking like three or four, or do you sometimes look at a dozen or more?
Oh, space, I would say every time we've moved, a minimum of 12 locations. Now, sometimes you might look at three or four suites in one building, but I would say if you're not looking at least 12 different spaces, you haven't really done your due diligence.
You mentioned leases a minute ago. They're obviously one of the most important considerations for a new office. What do practitioners need to look for? What are some of the hidden costs, for instance? And maybe if you could talk a little bit about how it's different if you're looking at moving from a home office to a quote-unquote real office, but maybe to also talk about, if you're a bigger organization, what some of the hidden costs might be if you've already got like some established offices in different cities.
Right. Well, there, first of all, there's a couple of options. You can either go get your own space and build it out to your liking, or there's also executive suites, and those have become very popular nationally, where they provide you, you know, quiet office, but they have a lot of common space. They've got meeting rooms. And so that would be, if you're going from a home office to a more traditional office, that may serve you well. Now, your cost per square foot is going to be much, much higher on that, but you get all the common space, and it can be a lot more flexible for you if you're, you know, bring on one or two more people. But if you are already, you know, practicing and you have some employees, and, you know, that you probably want to go in and get your own space, because the executive suites are a little cost prohibitive. So when we turn to actually negotiating the lease, and, you know, it's a lot different than, you know, renting an apartment or something. There are a lot of hidden costs, as you say. Most of them are triple net lease, where the tenant is responsible for property taxes, insurance, maintenance, including utilities. And so, you know, if your rent is $1,500, $2,000 a month, you need to put on another 20-25% when you start loading in all these other costs. And then there's also CAM charges, which are the common area charges. And those, the formulas are all over the board. And there's actually real estate and CPA firms that make a living out of going in there and checking the CAM charges, because it's pretty traditional you get overcharged on that. So you got to watch it.
I see. So a lot of times when people move into a new space, you know, they're thinking about the here and now, and they're just hoping that everything works out, quite frankly. But what happens if you have the best case scenario? What happens if your firm grows? Should you try to plan for that possibility when negotiating a lease, or is it just not something you should be worrying about when you're negotiating that lease?
That's an excellent point, Chris. And you definitely want to try and negotiate that on the front end. It depends on how hot the market is, but if you go into a building that maybe is only 60% occupied, it's a great time to add those types of provisions where you would say, hey, we'd like the right of first refusal for the two adjacent spaces. And then that way, you know, if you don't want to have a situation where you expand and then you have to put people on another floor, and we've certainly had that many times in our firm's growth, but you want to give yourself the most flexibility, but you also don't want to take on more space than you need beforehand. Now, a lot of landlords will sometimes, if you know for sure you're gonna grow in the next 6 months or a year, sometimes they will give you excess space that they have. Maybe you can pay, you know, 30 cents on the dollar, 50 cents on the dollar, just to keep it occupied, you know, lock it up. And then, or sometimes they'll even give you free rent for 6 months if you sign a multi-year lease on that extra space. So there's a lot of flexibility there.
When it comes time to actually move in, how do you prepare for that? Are there some things that you can do to help cut costs? And maybe one of the, you know, to give you a prompt here, I know I've seen pictures of you actually painting walls in, you know, in offices that you've moved into to help cut costs. Are there things like that that you can do?
Well, yeah, that's not my forte, but I in the Park City office where rental spaces get snapped up fairly quickly, they don't give you any allowances, really. It's like take it or leave it in its current condition. And so the few thousand dollars it was going to cost to kind of rehab the space, I flew a friend out from California, and over a couple of days we just painted it ourselves and saved a couple thousand dollars. So that worked out. So the critical path and getting ready for the actual physical move, first of all, and these are all things that people, including myself, early on missed, but there is a huge lead time on office furniture. So you got to put in your orders long before you're going to move. And then you got to get the logistics, because you know you also don't have access to the suite, and where are you going to put this, you know, the property before you can move it in. So there's a whole lot of logistics, but that's probably the longest lead time. Then you want to paint it, put your window furnishings, all of those times. If you're going to recarpet, you want to do that before you move in and you start moving all the desks and chairs, because once you're in, it's really a pain to, start painting and things. The other thing to consider, when you're first starting off is there's a massive used furniture market out there, and, you can buy, and they do kind of gouge you on office furniture because they know it's in a business context. I'm serious. You can buy home furnishings for much cheaper than office furniture. They just add on extra. So anyway, don't rule out getting used furniture, because it's usually not been abused. It looks great, 4 or 5 years old. And you can get it for, 40, 50 cents on the dollar of what new would cost. And it's available right away.
That's a really good suggestion. You mentioned some lead times with like furniture. I'm wondering, are there any utilities that you need to worry about lead times with, and like internet access or anything like that? Or have you always had pretty good chance, have you always had a pretty good experience with that or not?
No, great question. And, now, it's fairly in vogue to, have a TV, with a business channel running in the office, and kind of keeping everybody informed, keeping clients informed when they're in the waiting area. And so it does, the cabling, all of that stuff. Sometimes the office, is not, as functional, because, maybe somebody was, not using it as a professional service firm in the past. So you do need to get plenty of lead time on that, or otherwise you'll be the first few days, you'll have all your people not work, having any internet. That's not very productive time. One other thing I wanted to add, though, is also stay away from cubicles as much as you can. They are a nightmare to install. They're a nightmare to tear down. And they also really limit your footprint of the office. And so there's a lot of new, new systems that, you can have walls like cubicles, but it's not all the integrated system. So again, for flexibility and the next move and things, stay away from cubicles. They're expensive to tear down and put back together.
Great. So before we move off the physical space aspect of it, do you have any advice for working with architects, or is that a whole other podcast unto itself?
Well, the architect would be, if you were building out a floor, and they would be very necessary, and to get your plans through plan check through the city. That's another huge lead time. If you're taking a lot of space, you have to, it's multiple weeks, if not months, to get approvals through the city. That's why I stay away from moving walls as much as possible.
Right.
You don't have to go through all that. But normally, about 90% of cases, you probably just need, at most, you don't need an architect. You only need a space planner and a designer. And usually, a lot of the companies that, supply the desks and chairs and things, they usually, have one or two people internally that will also help you with the layout of your offices and things, and color schemes and things like that. So usually that's, the better option and more frequent use.
So the physical space is only part of the equation. The personnel are just as important, and really, honestly, they're more important. What's it take to attract folks to, when you're opening a completely new office? Is it harder to get them? And if so, what are some of the strategies that you've used in the past to make sure you get the right people?
No, great point. And so I've kind of seen both sides of it. The other three offices, have been in the same geographic areas as kind of where I was practicing before. This latest move was, 650 miles away from Southern California. And so I was in real uncharted waters when I came to Utah. And so I immediately reached out to the universities. BYU is close, University of Utah. And then, also just kind of got immersed into the business community through the Chamber of Commerce and Rotary. And that allowed me to kind of get the word out that I was hiring, and the resumes came, so that worked.
Very good. So you brought up going to like Chamber of Commerce and things like that. Are those some of the tips that you have for establishing the firm's brand in the community, doing things like that, maybe sponsoring a little league team or something?
Right. It's very, very important, especially when you're in a new community, to let the firm be known. And one of the best ways to do that, is I always recommend, joining a couple of organizations that would allow you to increase your visibility and, maybe also do some philanthropic work while you're at it. And so, I always tell them, Chamber, Kiwanis, Rotary, those types of organizations. Bigger cities usually will have a community foundation, a not-for-profit that, kind of helps all the other not-for-profits. So there's a lot of ways that you can get embedded in the community, and it's not only very rewarding from a personal standpoint, but also gets you integrated very quickly into the community.
Absolutely. So one more question before we go here. What's harder, moving for yourself personally, like moving to a new house, or moving to a new CPA firm office? What do you think is more challenging?
Oh, definitely moving offices, because at least most of us have a wife that'll help coordinate a lot of the home responsibilities. The work, you're kind of on your own.
Absolutely.
And it's not something that, you didn't have any classes in school. Your underlings have no experience in it, so you are really kind of on your own. Doing a lot of this, so, but it's rewarding in the end.
Absolutely. Thanks, Blake. I'd really like to thank you for taking the time to talk to us, and I'd also like to thank our audience for listening today. If you enjoyed this podcast, check out more JFA podcasts on our website and on Podomatic.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.